Personology is a production of iHeartRadio.
Martin Luther King Jr. was an activist, minister, and the most visible leader in the civil rights movement from 1955 until his death in 1968. He advanced civil rights through nonviolence and civil disobedience, inspired by his Christian beliefs and the nonviolent activism of Mahatma Gandhi. Welcome to Personology. I'm Dr. Gail Saltz, and my guest today is Claiborne Carson, director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute, and he's the Martin Luther King Jr. Centennial Professor in the History Department at Stanford University. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was born in 1929 in Atlanta to Alberta and Martin Luther King. King Sr. had taken over the ministry of Ebenezer Baptist Church from Alberta's father, and the church became the very center of their lives. The young Martin Luther had many influences in his upbringing, but none more central than his father.
He bore the name of his father. His father saw him as the firstborn son who was going to become a preacher himself. You know, I think that was kind of decided at an early age. And Martin was okay with that.
Were there things in his relationship with his father that would foreshadow the direction that he would ultimately take?
Well, he saw his father as a noble example. His father was someone who had come from poverty to work himself into a role of being one of the leading ministers at Atlanta. He had struggled to get through Morehouse College because he had not had very much preparation in his childhood for going to college. But he had managed to do that, and he had managed to marry the daughter of one of the leading ministers of Atlanta. For his son, he was the role model for what a minister could be, someone who was very concerned about the everyday lives of people in his congregation, someone who was outspoken on social issues. Mm-hmm. His father was a civil rights campaigner himself who actually led protests in Atlanta. And his grandfather had been a civil rights leader, head of the local chapter of the NAACP in Atlanta.
This really was his history. And it was expected that as someone who was essentially given more than his father, he could perhaps do more even than his father.
I think so. I think he felt that he had a very privileged childhood, unlike his father and grandfather who had grown up in poverty. He had grown up as the son of a affluent minister in Atlanta. And he had a sense that he had a gift of leadership that he could give back to the Black community and help, just as his father. He saw his father as someone who was always trying to work for the benefit of the Black community.
And what was his relationship like with his mother? How would you describe that?
I think he saw his mother as someone who was working behind the scenes. Obviously, his father was publicly prominent, but he described his mother as someone who was always taking care of everything. And he kind of developed that is a role model for what a wife should be, someone who stays home, takes care of the kids, but also has a lot of talents that can be valuable in the church, but more in the background. You know, working with the choir is something that is done. You don't get a lot of public praise for that, but you do it because it helps the church as a whole. So I think he grew up kind of understanding the gender roles, you know, that his mother was behind the scenes taking care of all the necessities, while his father was the person who was the public presence of the family.
Can you talk about personality traits that may have been evident from an early age? Was he a loquacious kid? Was he a competitive kid?
He was a good speaker. He won oratory contests as a young boy. He was someone who was concerned about social issues, outspoken. One of the things he did is he wrote a letter to the editor of the leading newspaper in Atlanta as a 15-year-old, protesting about the conditions that Black people face. And it got published, and that was the first publication by Martin Luther King.
Wow.
So So he was doing a number of things that indicated that he had this potential for leadership. He did go through a crisis in the sense of his religious faith. He was not a fundamentalist like his father. He questioned the Bible. He questioned many of the stories in the Bible. And it was only when he took a course by George Kelsey, his professor at Morehouse. That was the only course he got an A in. But it was also the course where he learned to reconcile some of his doubts, what Kelsey would call the deeper truths of the Bible. Some of the stories might be not literally true, but they conveyed moral truths, mm-hmm. and that those were more important than whether Jonah was really swallowed by the whale and, you know, many of the stories that are in the Bible.
So was that a departure from his father's ideology then?
Yes, I think he saw his father as more of a fundamentalist, that the Bible was just the truth. It was the word of God. It was not to be questioned. But I think Martin was someone who question things. And that actually prepared him for his ministry.
Martin graduated Morehouse in 1948 at the age of 19 with a BA in sociology. He then went on to Crozer Theological Seminary to continue his education.
Crozer Theological Seminary was one of the more advanced. And what I mean by that is it was more than simply training people to be ministers. It was training then to answer these theological questions. They had to understand that the Bible was a historical document. You know, that it was not all written at the same time. And it was important to distinguish the different books of the Bible. Some of them were contradicted one another. So all of these things were part of the deeper study of the Bible that he did during his time at Crozier. And it was there also that he really developed his intellectual gifts. He was not a gifted student as an undergraduate, but once he got to Crozier, he realized that his mind really was drawn to theological questions, and he wanted to know what was the role of the modern minister. How can ministry actually help the people in terms of their everyday problems? One of the papers that he writes when he's at Crozier, he says that as a minister, he will deal with problems like unemployment, slums, and economic insecurity. You know, I think he's still maybe 19 or 20 years old when he writes that. So he's already laid out his life plan that he's not simply going to be preaching to his congregation. He's going to be preaching a gospel, he called it the social gospel, that will help them deal with their everyday problems.
Was that a departure from how one went about being a minister, that was not the norm?
I think it was unusual in the sense that within the Baptist church, most ministers felt that their job was simply to deal with salvation, to emphasize the need for belief. His notion was that, yes, you need to do that, but you need to do more than that. You need to address the social issues that your congregation is dealing with. Wasn't enough to simply save their souls. You needed to make the world in which they lived something where they would be able to provide for their families and deal with the problems that he thought were important, you know, especially these economic issues of poverty. He turned Christianity into a means of making the society better. That's something that doesn't happen in most churches, at least at that time. You know, most ministers were content to simply tell the biblical stories and draw the moral lessons from them and not see the need to involve themselves in issues like civil rights.
Let's take a quick break here. We'll be right back. After King graduated from Crozier Theological Seminary in 1951, he again decided to continue his education, this time working on his doctorate at Boston University. And he was a very social, affable. It seems that he, even in those early years, got along well with people, had a real charisma. People were already drawn to him.
People who knew him when he was going to Boston University sometimes referred to him as the prince. You know, he was a person who, while many students struggle academically while they're going through school, he had a new car when he came to Boston. He had an apartment paid for by his father. He was popular among both men and women. He was a socially engaging person, someone who was well-respected by those around him. So he had that charisma that you see later in his life.
And he was drawn to Coretta Scott, 2 years older than him?
Yeah.
A singer, musically talented, somebody who perhaps was less interested in being behind him and only a support and not having any accolades of her own?
When he first called her in Boston in 1952, she wasn't that interested in going out with him. She was training to have a career in music, and the last thing she wanted to do was become a minister's wife, kind of raising the kids and staying in the background. She wanted to have her own career. She was reluctant, but after they went out a few times, she began to be drawn to him. She saw his talent and his charm and was, I think, convinced that maybe she could achieve some of her life goals by being his wife. But that took a while. Their courtship was difficult. If you look back at the letters that he wrote to her, you can see that they went through some difficult times, especially when he asked her to come to Atlanta and meet his parents. She wasn't quite ready to do that. She knew how strong an influence Daddy King was on his son. So they fought over that. And you could see that there was a chance that the relationship might have broken up over that. She knew what she was giving up, and she had studied very hard. And one of the things that happened even after they became engaged to each other is that she insisted that she complete her education at the New England Conservatory of Music.
Mm-hmm.
And even after their marriage, she was the one who organized what she called freedom concerts that would raise money for the movement. And during that time, she was also a strong pacifist. She was affiliated with an organization called the Women's International Strike for Peace. So she had her own political involvement. She had been a member of the Progressive Party during the 1940s.
Was she influenced by him in that way? I mean, was that something that she came to him with, that they happened to agree on?
I think it was more the opposite, is that she was the one who was the more politically engaged when they met. Martin had never been involved in a protest. I mean, she was, first of all, just older. She knew Black political leaders like Paul Robeson. She had sung in a concert with him. So she knew the older generation and admired this older generation of Black activists. There's a wonderful picture I have of her at the Progressive Party convention in 1948. So at a time when Martin is still a teenager, she's already at a national political convention. And later on in the 60s, she's the one who speaks out against the war in Vietnam before Martin does.
So is she the major influence for him in terms of the aspect of his career that had to do with pacifism and using nonviolent methods to make change?
I think what I would see is that they both influenced each other.
Mm-hmm.
That we shouldn't see her as simply following him and not the other way around either. I think both had strong ideas. His came out of his religious faith. Hers came out of her political activism. She went to a very liberal arts school in Antioch. Many of the students were, I guess, what you would call leftists, politically engaged. And he had never had an opportunity to do that because his education was more in the South at Morehouse, and he was exposed to ideas. I remember once she told me, said, I met Martin. He had a lot of wonderful, really interesting ideas, but he had never really done very much. So I think that if he had just not had the opportunity to develop politically because of his own background, and because when they met, he was barely old enough to vote.
After school, Martin and Coretta moved back to Coretta's home state of Alabama, deciding Montgomery was the best place to start their family.
They both wanted to return to the South. She had grown up in rural Alabama. He, of course, in Atlanta, Georgia. And they had both agreed that they would try to move back to the South and bring their progressive ideas into that region and try to be part of the movement for change.
So he becomes a minister of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church.
Right. And Dexter Avenue Baptist Church had been a place where many of the politically active black residents of Montgomery, that was their church.
Mm-hmm.
And the previous minister, Vernon Johns, had been a politically active minister. So that's one of the reasons why he chose that church, is he felt that these were people who would be receptive to his kind of theology. He didn't know, of course, that there was going to be a bus boycott movement there.
Mm-hmm.
That was more an accident of history, that he was in the same place as Rosa Parks. At that point, he had to make a decision about whether he was going to take a role as a civil rights leader in terms of the bus boycott.
In December of 1955, Rosa Parks was arrested for refusing to follow a bus driver's order to move to a seat in the back of the bus to accommodate a white passenger. The local chapter of the NAACP had been waiting for a test case like this to challenge the issue of bus segregation. The NAACP met at Dr. King's church, and King was eventually elected to lead the boycott. It's hard to know what would have happened if he didn't happen to be in the same place.
I think that that's one of the aspects of Martin Luther King's life that I think most people don't understand, is that to some degree he was in the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
That we wouldn't be talking about Martin Luther King if he had gone to Mobile, Alabama, rather than Montgomery, Alabama, for his first church.
Sometimes when we're talking about someone great in history who created something, who discovered something, who there were other people percolating around at the same time who might have been the one, but for, were there other people who might have been the Martin Luther King if it wasn't him?
Yes, definitely. To some degree, Rosa Parks had been a man and then a prominent person in the community. Now she might have become the leader, you know. But I think that he himself had some doubts about whether he should put himself forward when he was unexpectedly selected to lead the boycott movement.
Mm-hmm.
He had just declined an offer to become an officer, maybe the president of the local NAACP chapter. So he probably felt that, you know, this is his first church. Maybe I should spend a few years kind of getting used to being a minister. And also he knew the dangers of becoming a civil rights leader.
What in his past do you think would have prepared him or enabled him to take on that risk? He himself said, I'm not going to live past 40. And indeed he did not. But he clearly did understand the dangers. And many men might have said, I can't do this, or just steered away.
I think that his father gave him a role model of someone who was outspoken, even when it involved risk. His father leads a march back in the 1930s. He was probably taking as much of a risk as Martin is going to take later on.
Mm.
So I think he saw his father as a role model in this. And I think he also just had a deep religious faith. Whenever he had doubts, which he did have many times during the Montgomery movement, should I have done this? You know, especially when it leads to the bombing of his home, when his wife and newborn baby are in the home. These are things that would cause doubt for anyone.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And the threats that he received constantly. He talks about the crisis that he faced one evening when he receives a particularly threatening call, threatening not only himself, but his wife and daughter. He recalls that as time when he thought, do I have the strength to face up to this and to carry on despite these threats? It's basically his deep faith that God is with him in the struggle that allows him to carry on.
And did Coretta feel the same way? Did she also feel supported by her faith in terms of supporting him doing these things?
Yes, yes, I think so. There's a moment a couple of months into the boycott, and both his father and Coretta's father, this is after they've been threatened, house bombing, and both of their fathers come and try to persuade them to leave, and especially Coretta to leave and take the baby and not be in Montgomery anymore. And they both say, no, we're going to stay. We're going to come through this. But there is that effort on the part of Daddy King and her father to say, you need to think of your daughter. you need to take care of yourselves.
How much was ambition for him a driver in terms of a need to not turn back and push forward?
I think he wanted to be a great minister. I don't think that his ambition from the beginning was to become a great civil rights leader.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that is something that he grew into. And again, some of that is happenstance. Some of it is things that he could not have predicted. First of all, he could not have predicted that the Montgomery bus boycott was going to succeed.
Right.
That's what thrust him into the national limelight. If you go back after the success of the Montgomery bus boycott, which could not have been predicted, because it really came about not so much because the local white leaders gave in to the boycott itself, but that the Supreme Court intervened and overturned the bus segregation statute. That came at a time when Martin thought maybe the movement wasn't going to succeed because the city leaders were issuing an injunction against the boycott. So I think that only gradually does Martin realize that, yes, I am a leader. I didn't choose this, but he has a number of talents that make him a very effective leader, and particularly the fact that he's articulate and can articulate the goals of the movement. I think that's what his great skill was.
Did he have religious thoughts that he was in some way chosen to be the leader?
I think that he always felt that that was more accidental.
It seems that even as he had doubt, there was something about him and his temperament, his character, that he was willing to take risks, especially obviously in this instance with what was on the line.
I think after a while, he finds that he doesn't have a choice to be a leader. A black leader during the 1960s, especially in the South, you take risks.
Mm-hmm.
There are leaders like Medgar Evers who are assassinated during that time.
Mm-hmm.
So he understands that death could be around the corner. He's assaulted. You know, even before the Birmingham campaign, he has a stabbing incident in New York where a woman comes up and stabs it in the chest, and that might have been the end of him. He has another moment in Birmingham where he's there giving a talk, and a Nazi who is sitting in the audience comes up and assaults him. That person could have had a gun, and he would have been dead. So he has a number of incidents that remind him of his own mortality. I remember talking with Andrew Young, and he mentioned that Martin had a scar on his chest from the stabbing in 1958. And that every morning when he dressed, he would see that scar on his chest.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a constant reminder of his mortality and how close he had come to being killed.
Let's take a quick break here. We'll be right back. In 1963, six large civil rights organizations came together to organize the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. In the end, between 200 and 300,000 people of various races and backgrounds attended the march. The most well-known moment by far is Dr. King's famous "I Have a Dream" speech.
I have a dream. My poor little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
He is making strides. He meets with the president. He rallies larger and larger numbers of people to him. So at the same time, these obviously dangerous things are happening, these frightening things are happening, he sees himself making some progress.
I think his greatest fear was not of death, because I think he had to come to terms with that. I mean, it was certainly a fear, but I think his greatest fear was failure.
Mm-hmm.
When he becomes a leader, every time he puts his leadership on the line, you know, like he does in Albany, Georgia, or Birmingham, each of those occasions, the movement can fail. Toward the end of the Montgomery bus boycott, he goes to court thinking that in the courtroom, he's going to find out that the city leaders in Montgomery are going to issue an injunction banning the bus boycott. So he thinks it might be over.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, he gets the message that the Supreme Court has ruled in favor of the boycott. After leaving the jail in Birmingham, many of his staff say that the movement is likely to fail, because he had gone to the jail and written a letter for Birmingham jail, but when he comes out of jail, the situation in Birmingham had not changed very much. There was no indication that the city leaders in Birmingham were going to give in to the demands of the movement.
So there were many instances where he felt, and rightfully so, on the edge of success or failure, but things went well.
Yeah, sometimes for reasons that couldn't have been predicted, like the children's marches that happened after he came out of jail. It was really the teenagers who went to jail who turned the tide in Birmingham, and no one could have predicted that.
And throughout all of this, Coretta supports him. She's raising his children. Obviously, he has to travel a lot. He's moving around. He is certainly an admirable father, but she's the present mother. There's been long discussion over fidelity and Martin Luther King Jr. And clearly, he stayed married for his life. It's described as sometimes tumultuous, but certainly a loving marriage. But he's not always faithful. How do we understand that in the context of this man?
The way I understand it is that a lot of great people are not perfect people.
Mm-hmm.
If we have the qualification that you cannot show greatness in one area of life while you are less than admirable in another area of life, then we would eliminate a lot of people who become wonderful presidents and leaders in varieties of areas of life.
Yes.
Simply because someone is a minister doesn't necessarily mean that they always live up to their own expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that really gets to the heart of Martin and Coretta. I think that throughout their marriage, they loved each other, drawn to each other, because of their common interests in changing the world for the better, their common interests in their children. But there were a lot of strains, and particularly when you have a husband who is traveling throughout the country, you know, after the success of the Montgomery bus boycott, Martin begins to be invited everywhere. There are months in the early 1960s where he might be away from home more than he's at home. And he goes to places where there's admiring crowds waiting for him. The temptations are always there. When I look at his own reflections on this, he understands that there are examples in the Bible, and he cites them of King David. And one of the things that I think is true is that he does feel, as he's reaching the end of his life, and he has these visionary goals of eliminating poverty, eliminating war, as well as eliminating racial discrimination, that maybe he won't be able to succeed because he is a flawed leader. And he gives that wonderful sermon, Unfulfilled Dreams,
mm-hmm.
where he talks about that and just says, you know, look, all I can say is I tried to be a good man and hopes that God will understand.
You don't need to go out this morning saying that Martin Luther King is a saint. Oh, no. I want you to know this morning that I'm a sinner like all of God's children, but I want to be a good man.
A lot of leaders who people surround and, you know, admire develop a hubris over time, you know, the experience of being the leader, and aren't able to, even to themselves, acknowledge their flaws. It sounds as though you're saying he was aware and he had remorse for the things that he might have done that were essentially in his own mind not moral. And perhaps that made him a better leader in many ways.
I've never encountered a saint, at least that I know of. And I think that as I study people in the past, what interests me is that they are complex individuals. What makes them interesting is that complexity. If you have someone who is always living the perfect life, they might be a wonderful person, but not very interesting to a historian who looks at people who are in very many ways complex individuals who do things that are good, things that are not so good.
Mm-hmm.
And you just take all of that together and you don't try to make them into saint-like people.
Well, there's no question that our world has been changed forever by Martin Luther King.
And by so many other people who are also complex individuals. And we focus on him because he's the most famous, but he's not really in some respects that much different from many other people who mm-hmm. who also played important roles during this period of of change.
In 1968, Dr. King was in Memphis, Tennessee, supporting the black sanitation workers while they were on strike for higher wages and better treatment. At a rally for the workers, King gave his "I Have Been to the Mountaintop" speech. In it, King references bomb threats made recently against him and says, quote, "And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we, as a people, will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything."
So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
The very next day, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated while standing on his motel's second-story balcony. Do you have thoughts as a historian, had he not been assassinated, the ways in which he might have changed things further? Were there things on the horizon that it looked like he might impact had he lived a longer life?
Oh, of course, yeah. I think that he had just started his life. When you compare him to someone like Gandhi, at the age of 39, Gandhi had done nothing really in India. He had achieved some change in South Africa. But all the things that we think of in terms of Gandhi's accomplishments, they were still in the future when he was 39. For Martin Luther King to be assassinated at what is really an early age, what I would see is that, yeah, he had a lot he would like to have accomplished. One of the ironies is that because his visionary goals were so visionary, there would be no Martin Luther King holiday if Martin Luther King had lived, because he would have been seen as someone trying to achieve things that were unachievable, eliminating poverty, as they said, eliminating war. Do you think he could have really, on his own, stopped the war in Vietnam and stopped all the wars since then? He was trying to do something very radical. You know, just think of the Poor People's Campaign. I described it to my students in terms that they would understand. I said, imagine an Occupy movement. Some of them remember the Occupy movements of 10 years ago. Imagine that a leader today said, I'm going to go and occupy the National Mall of the United States until Congress passes anti-poverty legislation. You know, just think of how radical that would be, how audacious that would be. So I think that Martin Luther King, if he had lived, he would have been seen as this radical leader. And you don't make radical leaders into national holidays. So I think that what happened was that because he was assassinated before that saw the end of what he was doing in terms of the Poor People's Campaign, that it was then possible to say, let's honor this person because he was associated with this great civil rights movement.
Right. And that is the place that he made impact. And that is the place where we saw incredible change following his time.
The Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Civil Rights Act of 1965 were momentous changes in the history of the United States, perhaps as important as the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution. So we make Martin Luther King a national holiday because he is the person most associated with that civil rights revolution. You know, you can't choose a better person for that. For him, that was simply part of his vision, part of what he wanted to accomplish with his life.
But our national psyche, I guess what you're saying is the combination of his success in this particular arena and his sudden death, which essentially martyred him, made us see him in a certain light.
Yes. I noticed that on Martin Luther King holiday, there's a tendency to replay the I Have a Dream speech, but not his speech attacking the war in Vietnam, because that's still controversial, what he says in that speech.
We have destroyed their two most cherished institutions, the family and the village.
It is our national psychology that has essentially, in some ways, immortalized him further.
Yes.
Well, that wraps things up for this episode. A huge thanks to Dr. Claiborne Carson. For more on MLK's life and work, check out his edited volumes of The Papers of Martin Luther King Jr. Also, if you're interested in more information about the people we discuss in this series, you can check out my book, The Power of Different. And make sure to follow me on Twitter at Dr. Gail Salt or at PersonologyMD to follow along with all the latest news about the show.
Personology is a production of iHeartRadio. The executive producers are Dr. Gail Saltz and Tyler Klang. The supervising producer is Dylan Fagan. The associate producer is Lowell Berlanti. Editing, music, and mixing by Lowell Berlanti. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.